Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello and welcome to Nature Now for the second week of November. I am your co-host, Megan Selva. On this episode, Ken Wilson will be interviewing our guest, Bob Steelquist, a native Pacific Northwest writer, naturalist, and environmental educator. He served as education coordinator for NOAA's Olympic Coast National Marine Sanctuary until retiring in 2014, and now has a book out called The Northwest Coastal Explorer. And I'm sure Ken and Bob will elaborate upon that. I will be sharing observations, news, and upcoming events. Before we get to the main topic with Ken and Bob, let's hear the mystery sound of the week. This mystery bird often holds its short tail up and bounces up and down on rocks and rushing streams. Their song is clear and ringing with repeated notes. You may see their dome-shaped nest on cliff ledges, behind waterfalls, on boulders, or under bridges, but always above or close to fast-moving streams. Let's play that sound again and tell you more about it at the end of the program. Now to continue the show, here is Ken Wilson's interview with the wonderful naturalist Bob Steelquist.
Hi, I'm Ken Wilson with Nature Now, and we're here with Bob Steelquist, who is an author, an adventurer, a naturalist, an environmental educator, a photographer, and welcome to Nature Now. I've interviewed Bob before, so this will be fun.
Thanks, Ken. It's nice to be back.
Where did you come about in your evolution? How did you become a naturalist and excited about this, and an environmental educator and photographer and so forth?
I grew up in the Northwest, and I was fortunate that my parents really believed in getting us outside. I also lived at a time when the suburbs bled easily into remote countryside and farmland, and I lived under rules of benign neglect on my mother's part, and so we had freedom to roam.
We're going to get soon enough into revisiting your book, which is titled The Northwest Coastal Explorer. What really pivotal, wonderful experience have you had? I think our audience will love hearing this.
Well, I was fortunate in my career with NOAA to have lots of wonderful experiences, and I lumped the top five into one experience, and that was a project that we conducted at Olympic Coast National Marine Sanctuary together with Dr. Sylvia Earle and National Geographic. And as a communicator, as an educator, a writer, a photographer, I was selected to be trained to dive a one-person submersible. And so through the training, learned how to operate a submarine all by myself.
Wow.
And then our missions were conducted off of the Olympic coast, off of Cape Alava and around the Nia Bay vicinity. So the process of training was very, very exciting. And then the dives themselves.
How deep did you
300
go?
Feet.
300 feet. Is it light still at 300
feet? It's pretty dark down there.
So you're a gutsy guy, kind of guy.
It was interesting. I in my deepest dive, I actually got to the bottom, sat on the bottom. And I was curious because some fish are attracted to light, some are repelled by it. And I decided I'd shut the lights off completely and sit there in total darkness and then turn them back on and see who came in.
There wasn't any bioluminescent stuff out there, was there?
It was dark.
It was dark. Okay. Anyway, so heading towards your book, The Northwest Coastal Explorer, which I should mention, you'll be speaking to the Port Townsend Marine Science Center November 11th at 3 p.m. at the Fort Worden Chapel. I'll just repeat that quickly. November 11th, 3 p.m., Fort Worden Chapel. And it'll be on the Marine Science Center, Port Townsend Marine Science Center's website. And with that said, and hopefully some of the audience will attend your talk there, what's been attracting readers to your book?
It's been very satisfying. You know, you work really hard. You're out there taking photographs and you're, you know, slaving and procrastinating as a writer, as writers always do. You get this thing done, you turn it over to a publisher, they transform it into a product, it goes off, gets printed, and then suddenly it's available. Well, I move on to other projects, and this book enters the world and begins to do its work. And I'm delighted on a regular basis to hear from readers and booksellers and librarians that the book has really found an audience. I don't know exactly what the sales numbers are, but I take great comfort in knowing that there are thousands of these books out there. I haven't seen any in Goodwill stores yet, but the book is doing its job. And what people like is the voice. They like the approachability, the non-technical ability, the qualities of it. They like the pictures, of course, but they like the stories.
Beautiful photos, I might add.
Well, thank you. Yeah, they like the stories of common things, the things that make up the environment around us, whether it's geology or plants or animals.
Yeah. Well, let me interject something here, because I started hiking and backpacking and being a naturalist and birder when I was a kid. And, of course, as a hippie, you'd bump into all sorts of other hippies in the mountains backpacking. And now you see young people especially, but virtually everyone, staring at their iPhone. And I'm wondering, in your experience, are there more or fewer individuals being engaged in nature now, or are we obsessed with iPhones?
Well, I'm actually really encouraged, because the generation of millennials are all coming into family-bearing ages now, and certainly social relationships where they like doing things outdoors. And I actually feel that the proliferation of information, whether it's through books or whether it's through apps, is really encouraging younger people, particularly, to engage in the things that they engaged in as children, that we as their parents and as our parents showed us. I'm actually very encouraged. I think the information now is at everyone's fingertips. You can have an app that will identify a bird call for you.
Right, yeah.
You can plot the sun's course across the sky to figure out where it's going to set.
Yeah.
You can hold your phone up and identify the silhouettes of mountains in the distance.
Yeah. So along these lines, what are you hearing from booksellers and audiences about your book?
They like it. They really like it. They find it to be really friendly. And I hear from people that want to take it with them in their minivan or their SUV, wherever they go outside in the Northwest with their families. One particular audience I'm really, really pleased to hear from are young environmental educators. These are naturalists themselves. They're the ones that are working with kids these days, in and out of schools, on field trips. One young woman approached me at an event, opened her day pack, and brought out the most dog-eared, beat-up, highlighted, post-it notes stuck all over a copy of my book I could ever imagine.
Oh, nice. Well, my next question relates directly to your book, because obviously your knowledge exceeds the number of pages that your publisher will allot. And there are things when we're out in nature that either perhaps help us or distract us from being totally present and getting a nice endorphin high. So one of these is, and this relates to your book, to what extent should your book or should we be really targeting, oh, I need to know the name of this one and this one and this one, versus just saying, hey, that's a really pretty critter, or I like the way that eagle soars, or what have you, even if we don't know the name of it.
Human beings and our the way we understand the world, it happens in a couple of ways. There's no one or the other. Yeah, we're namers. The interesting thing is when Linnaeus conceived the binomial system in Latin of naming every living thing, a lot of the Latin names simply were descriptive names. So we don't speak Latin anymore, so it's a chore for us to memorize and may seem irrelevant, but a lot of those names are actually very descriptive. But to the deeper point, Leonardo da Vinci once famously said, probably in Italian, that our knowledge really begins with experience. You know, the layers of facts, the layers of information come afterward. We really begin with experience. And so I I play it both ways. Yeah. If the curiosity draws them into a question about a name and the name is going to help them appreciate and recognize something, okay, we'll go that way. But if people really want to use their senses to observe, to appreciate, you know, the qualities, the right. texture of the leaf, the smell of the air, you know, the temperature of the water, I encourage that. And I think once we have those experiences, that experience drives our curiosity.
Which makes sense, totally.
And then we go home and we look it up.
Yeah, because when you think about 99 people out of 100, being able to observe salmon leaping a cascading river, 99 out of 100 people would get a charge out of that, even if they didn't know the name of which kind of salmon it is.
Exactly.
Well, okay, so the naming or not naming, you've addressed that. Now, another one. You're a nature photographer, and using my own experience as an example, I went down to see the Oregon eclipse this year, and I was so obsessed with taking pictures of it that time, that very, very brief interval of time came and went. And I thought, all I did was obsess about my pictures, and I didn't really directly engage with the eclipse. And likewise, I was on a safari in Africa, and I'm just clicking away with my photos and didn't directly engage with that. So to what extent is your ability to photograph not interfering with your ability to be present? Like, how do you pull that off?
Well, first of all, I'm a visual explorer. As I approach a scene or a place, I have an idea where I am and what I want to photograph, but I assess it visually. I try and find out where the wind's coming from. It's important to know where the light is. And then as I begin to photograph, I look at my photographs as documentation of a visual experience. Yeah. Not specifically capturing a subject. Now, it works that way in documentary photography. You want a picture of the critter that you're writing about. But I look at photography as the documentation or the recording of a visual experience. And that visual experience has all the richness of involving all of my senses. There's also a great danger in nature photography to photographers, and that is when you get so myopic and you're stuck in your viewfinder or you're on the screen that you walk off cliffs or you fall.
And you're being literal about this.
I am, yeah. And, you know, we tend to get so obsessed with the picture that we forget the hazards around us. And I've had experiences where I've taken some bad falls because I just wasn't paying attention as nature was instructing me to feel the slippery surface under my feet or pay attention to the water, the rocks. Being so engrossed in the photography got me hurt.
Oh, okay. Hey, moving on to another topic, which is an area you're really passionate about, the controversy with orcas. Why don't you get into some of that?
Well, we're witnessing a very, very sad episode in a relationship between people and wildlife. We've come to identify with particularly the southern resident population of killer whales or orcas, and we're seeing a precipitous decline. My concerns run really deep because, first of all, this is a very, very complex problem. There's no single answer. There's no single category of answers or solutions to this. But one of the observations that I've made is that in our rush to either point fingers at someone or away from ourselves, we're really narrowing the conversation to matters that don't matter to the whales, that are more about things that we care about.
Give some more info on that.
Well, for example, from the conflicts over fish resources, before we really started looking holistically at fish populations, it was always somebody else's fault. We have to look now in the crisis with the southern resident population that, you know, we have a shortage of salmon, we have toxics in the water, we have noise. We have the intrusion 40 years ago into the disruption of the generational pattern, and we're living out the consequences of the loss of reproductive animals at the height of their health in those days when whales were captured and taken from this population.
You know, let me ask you this, because a couple of moments ago you mentioned a precipitous decline, and just now you mentioned whales being taken from this area and popped into, you know, sea worlds and so forth. Well, what are we talking about in terms of precipitous decline, like numbers?
Well, the numbers of individuals continue to go down, but more importantly, the capacity of that population to sustainably reproduce is what's at danger.
Right.
We tend to get fixated on numbers when we look at populations and often forget about the population processes themselves and the interactions that are really far more complicated and really more significant. But conservation biologists have and sometimes become really impatient with science as it's applied to the environment because science seems to be too slow. We tend to focus too much on particulars and forget to see the picture.
Right.
So, you know, a concept was developed called the precautionary principle, which is simply taking precautions in advance when you see something that could cause harm is being careful. It means taking preventative measures before there are the signal events that may be the point of no turning back. It means shifting the burden of proof to proponents of certain activities that may be harmful instead of the burden of proof to prove that it's harmful before you stop it, to explore alternatives.
You know what? Getting back to that precautionary principle, you and I had talked prior to this interview, the seatbelt example or the cell phones on planes.
Yeah, exactly. The precautionary principle is not old. It's really common sense. You know, the dictum to the doctor of do no harm is a precautionary principle. In the 1990s, when cell phones became pretty commonplace, there was anecdotal evidence that it might interfere with radio or navigational devices on airplanes. FAA examined that and found no credible evidence that it happened. And yet, the consequences of one plane crash because somebody answered their phone was just unacceptable.
Yeah, that's not good.
And now we all accept that ban. That's the precautionary principle. Seatbelts. There's a very, very tiny chance that you will be killed in your car today if you're not wearing a seatbelt. And yet, none of us are really willing to bet on that that's certain that we won't. So we put on the seatbelts and we accept laws that say you have to have seatbelts.
Right.
That's the precautionary principle.
So applying this to our southern resident orca population, a couple of things you had mentioned to me earlier were, for example, a voluntary moratorium on whale watching trips, for example.
This strikes the heart of our community of naturalists and those who really love the experience. And yet we're the ones that care the most. And the precautionary principle says, look at all the options. Vessel traffic noise is a real factor. Yes, we can point to a lack of food. With all the king salmon in the world, if whales are disturbed to the point that they can't hunt and can't eat, it doesn't matter how many fish we have. So I've given this a lot of thought. I've been on lots of whale watching trips. I know that they're very professionally operated, but when you see this in operation, you see, okay, everybody out there on that given day knows where the whales are. Often now we're seeing 20 or 30 vessels. And the behaviors I've seen over the years have become now whales are showing just profound avoidance. And it's relentless. So you have to ask, okay, are we as the community of people that love these animals, love the experience of being with them, are we really one of many factors? And if so, can we step up and say, we don't want this to happen and we're willing to accept a seasonal moratorium or because we know where fish are and we know where whales, accept some whale sanctuaries where, or can we limit this to just making sure that the southern resident populations are relieved of the disturbing pressure of all this boat traffic?
Yeah. Well, thanks so much. And we'll finish with one last thing. There's a lot of bad news out there. And what are some ways we can retain some optimism and joyfulness with all this amidst the bad news?
Well, we over the history of the environmental movement have become the naysayers and the doomsayers, and that's unfortunate because we really hold the future. This viewpoint that we have is really about a future that we hope is sustainable and not just gives us pleasure or joy as individuals or as groups, but maintains our connection as organisms, as sensory systems to this world around us. And I think socially, being in the environment, reinforcing the joys we experience with other people, reinforcing the things that we learn with other people, and reinforcing the importance that as a body politic that we can really have some influence. And that's the antidote, I think, to the doom.
To be surrounded by folks who share the passion and where we're out in nature really enjoying ourselves.
To be surrounded in the world we're a part of and know it and feel it and be grateful for it.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Bob.
Thank you.
And we look forward to hearing your talk, November 11, 3 p.m., Fort Worden Chapel, Marine Science Center event. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you are looking to get out, learn, or volunteer, here are some upcoming events. Definitely don't miss out on the Northwest Coastal Explorer with Bob Steelquist, part of the lecture series, The Future of Oceans, which takes place in the chapel at Fort Worden this Sunday, November 11th at 3 p.m. More info on the Port Townsend Marine Science Center website. Tonight from 6 to 9 p.m. is a series, Thinking Through the Land, with Dr. Nadine Maestas, The Poetry and Poetics of Cascadia. Dr. Maestas is a poet, educator, and advocate for the Cascadia bioregion. She will offer poems and stories about her experiences, bringing a sense of place to her work and her work in the natural world. Originally a native of New Mexico, her early days were spent hiking and fishing with elders, learning how to value wild places and strong spirits, now a force to be reckoned with in her own right. Dr. Maestas has presented papers and given readings that break down barriers between the artist and her subject. She will lead a lively discussion following her talk. The lecture will be held at the Finn River Cider Garden in Chimicum tonight at 6. For more information, check out the Jefferson Land Trust website, saveland.org. Another awesome series going on is the Focus On series with Dungeness River Audubon Center. This week is focused on kingfishers and herons. The event is on Saturday, November 10th from 10 a.m. to noon. You can join them to take a deep look at the behaviors, adaptations, habitats, conservation status, and much more of creatures we share our home with. This morning was the weekly bird walk with Dungeness River Audubon Center. If you would like to join, meet at the River Center to see and hear the birds of the Dungeness Riparian Forest every Wednesday morning from 8:30 to 10:30 a.m. Information from walks helps with understanding the annual cycle of birds in Railroad Bridge Park. All age and experience levels welcome to attend. More info at DungenessRiverCenter.org. Finally, on Tuesday, November 13th, join Jefferson Land Trust Build Benches that will be placed at various nature preserves across the county. The event will be located at the Jefferson Land Trust office in Port Townsend and starts at 10 a.m. Please RSVP on their website if you would like to volunteer. For further news and observations, NOSC's Real Learning, Real Work education program kicked off on October 16th and 19th with Chimicum and Blue Heron Schools. The Real Learning, Real Work program works with students in Jefferson and Clallam County to work alongside real restoration professionals at real restoration sites, learning the techniques that specialists use every day. Seventh grade students were captured working hard to develop plot maps, take soil samples, identify common trees and shrubs, and make creek observations. While learning about salmon habitat requirements, the students also enjoyed a taste of wild salmon, demonstrating traditional Native American fire roasting. A couple of months from now, these students will be working in the classroom to create plot maps and decide which native plant species to plant based on varying light and moisture requirements met by the plots. The program continues through the spring with planting and volunteer opportunities located from Port Townsend to Clallam Bay. If you're interested in getting out in the field with students in the future, contact NOSC. Joanne Carson gave a nice article in the Peninsula Daily News on Sunday, November 4th, called Birdwatch. Joanne Carson gave a nice article in the Peninsula Daily News on Sunday, November 4th, called Birdwatch, Size and More Matters. Here's a part of her observation. As I watched a ruby-crowned kinglet bathing with some golden-crowned kinglets, plus a flock of bush tits, I thought about the way different species hang out together for one reason or another. Bush tits would be comfortable bathing with tiny kinglets, but there are other factors that come into their association with one another. Food preferences are at the top of the list. When birds like to eat the same things as others their size, they will associate with these unrelated species. We can take advantage of this when trying to attract a wider variety of birds to our yard and feeders. Black sunflower seeds in the shell or not are the most popular food for Northwest birds. If you haven't heard her article yet, go to the Peninsula Daily News website and search the title Birdwatch, Size, and More Matters. Also, Sunday night while mushroom foraging with my fiancé and our friend Jimmy, we spotted a northern red-legged frog hiding under a log on our easement. The dorsal color was brown with varying amounts of black spotting and speckling. The undersides of the legs and margins of the abdomen were brick red. Its conservation status is of least concern, which is great to know. Amphibians make good indicator species because they live in two environments, land and water, and have thin, sensitive skin that they sometimes breathe through. Their thin skin can also absorb toxic chemicals, radiation, and diseases. If there are lots of frogs and other amphibians in a habitat, it indicates a healthy ecosystem. It was cool to see another type of frog on our property. They have been known to live as long as 15 years in the wild, mainly in colder areas of range. So here's our mystery sound again. That was a sweet sound of a chunky bird of western streams, the American dipper, also known as water ouzel. It is North America's only truly aquatic songbird. It catches all of its food underwater in swiftly flowing streams by swimming and walking on the stream bottom. To be able to survive in cold waters during the winter, the American dipper has a low metabolic rate, extra oxygen-carrying capacity in its blood, and a thick coat of feathers. They are found year-round in the North Atlantic. Hope you can spot them. And that's it for KPTZ's Nature Now for the second week of November. Thanks very much to Ken and our special guest, Bob Stilquist. And thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 12:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. As always, happy trails!
Today's musical selection was Saltwater by Geowolf. The show is edited by Nora Petrich.